Okay, why don't we get started? I'm going to talk about this morning is first to introduce a few of the principles of ecology and then try to show you why we're in the mix that we're in. In other words, basically it's a failure to observe some of these basic principles of ecology. First off, what does ecology mean? It's actually a study of plants and animals living together and in their environment. In other words, plants and animals in relation to each other and to the environment, including physical environment and biological. So the physical environment would be the soil, the air, the water, the oxygen system, and how they interact with each other. Usually when we study ecology, we study communities, and these would be communities of plants and animals, and we find that they have certain characteristics and relationships to make the community as it is. First off, we find that there is a balance, so-called, within this community. In other words, we have a variety of relationships occurring. Among these, we have competition, and we have interdependence. These are two of the fundamental characteristics of a community, and even human communities and societies, we have the same kind of thing. We have competition and interdependence. Both of these are necessary. If we didn't have competition, supposing everyone wanted to be a shoe salesman, well, you can imagine what kind of a world you have. And interdependence is also necessary for any kind of type of living, because just think of how many ways you are dependent upon others, you know, in the particular community. Well, okay, same thing with plants and animals. We have competition. We find that nature survives, produces many, many, many more seeds than can ever survive. Take, for example, the pollen even from trees, copious quantities, but of all that pollen, fertilized flowers, and all of those flowers survive, we have just one species. Take, for example, even bacteria. Bacteria can divide at a tremendous rate, and when they're growing optimum rate, we find that you start, in every 20 minutes, they double the population. So maybe if you have one, in 20 minutes you've got two. But supposing after several hours you've got 4 billion and the population doubles in 20 minutes, that's even worse than the United States population. And 4 million, 8 million, 16 million. So you can imagine we were going to be overtaken by bacteria. But this competition, you see, and competition for food, competition for space, and otherwise. So fortunately, they don't keep going at this particular rate. Another example of the fact that nature produces many more seasons to possibly survive. Take, for example, this ordinary fly, house fly. And supposing this house fly were to mate in April, and then supposing all of the progeny of that fly were to survive, plus, in other words, all of the eggs were to produce flies, and all of those flies that hatched within all of theirs would survive. In other words, what would we have by the end of the season, which would be about September, October? It would be more flies than would cover the earth for 47 feet deep. In other words, unbelievable how many flies we would have if all of these progeny survived. So obviously then there is competition, and only those that are capable of surviving do. And many, many do not survive. Also very important is this factor of interdependence, and this is a fundamental concept as far as ecology is concerned. Animals are very much dependent upon other animals and plants for food, and so develops another type of thing we have in ecology, the so-called food chain, and we think of it as sort of the pyramidal type structure in which the basis or the basic part of your food chain are the producers. And we could put down here then producers. And your fundamental producers are your green plants. If this were to be food chain in the ocean, your fundamental producers would be the algae, the plankton, the green algae, that the fish then and a fine would eat. But your fundamental producers then are plants. If the process of photosynthesis should stop, life also would stop. This is the single fundamental process, absolutely essential for continuation of life. Without photosynthesis, that we would have no food, essentially. That would be it. Whether you eat plants or don't eat plants, you are still basically dependent upon it, because what you eat does eat the plants, you see. And we could not produce food just out of chemicals. These would soon be run out. So this is the fundamental source of all life, then. The producers, your photosynthetic plants. Then above this, you may have the animals that eat plants. We could call them herbivores. And then above this, your carnivores, those that eat other animals and such. But another thing about this particular pyramid, we find that each time you go up a chain, that it can support less and less. In other words, you have to have a broad base of photosynthetic plants to support then just 10% of animals that would eat the plant. And every time you go up the chain, you lose 90% of the energy. They can only get 10% of energy out of the pine bivora. So again, there is this basic interdependence for food and other things as far as a community would be concerned. So competition and interdependence. Supposing now the community should get so-called out of balance for some reason or other. In other words, supposing something happens, your checks and controls are changed or the environment changes, then we find that there is a change in the community, and sometimes a drastic thing occurs. One rather naturally occurring thing that does frequently occur on the Pacific Coast is called the red tide. This would be a type of thing that can occur if one particular species does become, in other words, for a short period of time, competition is cut down and is able to compete too successfully, and then we have conditions that are out of balance. Okay, the red tide. How many of you have observed the red tide? You can see it on the Southern California coast, also apparently in Florida and the Gulf Coast. It's caused by a very minute organism called a dinoflagellate. What happens, usually when the water becomes unusually warm, these organisms are able to reproduce in vast numbers, such that when you, at the time of a red tide, just a teaspoonful of the water would contain just millions of these tiny microscopic organisms, dinoflagellates. As a result of the red tide, the water looks murky just because of the vast number of these organisms, and they produce toxic substances, plus utilize essential nutrients. As a result, other organisms die. There is a mass death of fish and other animals. So generally, at times of red tide, you can smell the odor of dead fish. The water is extremely murky. But one rather interesting aspect of it, too, is the fact that these dinoflagellates are bioluminescent. In other words, they produce light. And so at times of the red tide, when you have if you go there at night, the waves are breaking, you can observe this phosphorescence. It's absolutely fantastic right along the breakers. Apparently the exposure to oxygen plus the substances that the organisms give off produce this light effect. You can even write your name in the sand, because there's so many of these organisms, they're just all over. They're on the sand, whereas the water washes up and writes your name.
Are the chemicals the same as fireflies or nitrogen?
It is the same chemical substance. So red tide would be a type of thing out of balance. In other words, something has happened and this one particular organism takes over. What actually causes it, we don't know, but it seems to occur when the water is warm, which is usually in September, and also in areas where there appears to be an influx of fresh water coming into the ocean. And it is believed that the fresh water perhaps brings certain nutrients then that cause the dinoflagellates to be able to reproduce in great numbers. In Florida, for example, they, in the chaos before 1932, had relatively few red tides. I think there was one in 1916, one in 32, then 45. But then after the 50s, late 50s and 60s, they've been occurring very frequently, apparently, contaminants being put into the fresh water system.
Cold
is
less than the city of
Seattle. Is it by the next year? It depends. This may last for a week, 2 weeks, even several weeks.
Probably for real change in weather than for something to, or probably they just compete with themselves so much that they
Yeah, ultimately, when the weather does change or the water cools or something, we will die out. They do produce toxic substances or other dinoflagellates that produce toxic substances that actually, if you drank the water, I don't think it would hurt you, but this is concentrated in the mussels and the shellfish, and if you eat these, then you would be poisoned. Which brings out another aspect of this food chain. One of the reasons that DDT is so harmful is that it isn't necessarily that its presence in the water is a very great extent, but it collects in these particular organisms, and as you go up the food chain, it concentrates, because it tends to concentrate in the fatty tissue of the animal. If it is not excreted, and you see the more they consume, it would gradually increase in percentage. So in studies that have been made with respect to DDT, they found that the plants, first, basically the water has almost no DDT, very low level of it. The plants, the photosynthetic plants, are relatively low level. But as you go up the line in the food chain, it just becomes more and more concentrated, such that some of the birds and seagulls have a very high ratio of parts per million in comparison to the level that would be present. In other words, it becomes concentrated. Again, it varies with different people. Not all have the same, but again, there seems to be, we don't know what the effects of DDT are, but it does seem that in studies that they've made, people that have died of certain types of cancer do have a higher level of DDT, particularly liver. So it's a problem with DDT, too, the fact that it does tend to concentrate. In other words, it doesn't go away. It has a high longevity or half-life, so to speak, and it isn't easily removed from the environment. One of the problems, again, that we have actually produced as far as communities and such, is the simplifying of a community. All of our cultivated fields and most of the types of things that man has tampered with are simple types of communities in which you have just one crop or just a few crops. This also produces problems. It makes it then very easy for it to be destroyed or easy for parasites to take over. This is probably one of the reasons that we are so troubled, you see, with pests and otherwise. In the natural community, there are many, many different kinds of species and plants and animals. It isn't just one crop. So we'll take an example. The University of Illinois, they had nothing but elm trees all over the campus, all over the town, and all over. And elm trees are beautiful, no objection to them. But the only problem is, along came the Dutch elm tree disease and wiped out everything. Not only this, it's probably, if there hadn't been so many elm trees, maybe some of them would have survived. But you see, they're planted all in a line like so. Here's the skyline. And the roots actually interconnect. So no matter what spraying you do up top, you're going to do second good if the roots, you see, connect down below. And there's absolutely no way of preventing contamination, preventing infection. So while we were there, the university town became a town of stumps, elm stumps. So there they were, all stumps all lined up. So obviously you have to replace them somehow, and what did they do? replaced them all with honey locusts. So then it became a town of honey locust trees, up the line, honey locust down, up and down, nothing but honey locust. And the standing joke then in the botany department was, well, have you heard of the honey locust blight that was coming? We'd have then two stumps, an elm stump and a honey locust stump, and let's start over again. But these are one of, this is basically a problem of having just one crop makes it very difficult to prevent then destruction of it. Let me mention some of the factors of the environment that are important, and again, we man have been tampering with and have been solving the problem. First off, air is extremely important as an environment. Incidentally, people don't realize that plants also need air, not only above but below. One of the quickest ways of killing a plant is to give it too much water, believe it or not. Saturate the soil and prevent aeration in the plant. Very few plants can tolerate this. And so it's absolutely essential that the soil have aeration and plants have air. But air is also important. The substances present in it utilized and otherwise. We basically have a percentage of carbon dioxide that is necessary. It's a very low percentage, but it is essential that it be there. It not only tends to block out some of the harmful rays from the sun, but is also important as a raw ingredient for photosynthesis. However, supposing we increase the percentage of carbon dioxide, what's going to happen? This is another question. Carbon dioxide has a tendency to can act as sort of a blanket in the atmosphere. In other words, it will transmit the rays from the sun. But when, particularly certain types of rays, but when these re-radiate from the surface of the earth, they are usually in the form of infrared or heat, and then the carbon dioxide then acts as a blanket and prevents these from escaping back out to the atmosphere. This being the case then, if the percentage of carbon dioxide should increase considerably, it might result in producing a so-called greenhouse effect on the surface of the earth. What happens if you keep your car shut on a sunny day, you know, and it might be even cool outside. What about the car? You know, you open it up and you just about die with the, it's like opening up your oven. Well, this is a so-called greenhouse effect in which the glass acts as the blanket in the street. But carbon dioxide has the same effect. It will, can act as a blanket and could then result in raising the temperature of the earth. Well, how would it be possible to increase the carbon dioxide content? Well, very easy. Either a greater population of people, we require carbon dioxide, burning a lot of fuel, wood, oil, coal, all of these give off carbon dioxide, and then cutting down plants would again increase the carbon dioxide because of less utilization of carbon dioxide in photosynthesis.
Is carbon dioxide
single
and its ability to produce
an
infrared effect,
or is it just... water vapor does to an extent, too, and ozone. So it could be possible, then, that carbon dioxide could have this kind of an effect. Of course, there are other aspects, too, involved. Solid particles, such as the hydrocarbons and some of the other solid particles that we have in the air, and smog could also have an opposite effect, tend to prevent radiation from the sun. So what actually is going to happen in the future, we don't know. There are many unknowns as far as what will happen. But you're probably familiar with smog. Again, this is a problem not only as far as man is concerned, but also with plants. We find that along the LA freeway, many plants will not grow. A lot of the crops that they had originally grown can no longer be grown there. So again, the smog is not only injurious to man, but also to plant life, which is something else to be considered because we are dependent upon plants. So we are certainly polluting the air. What the effects are going to be, we don't know entirely, but probably not entirely, but certainly. Another thing I might mention concerning the air, there is presence of nitrogen in the air. This is important. We can't utilize it ourselves, but certain bacteria are capable of converting the nitrogen into usable nitrate, which then the plants use in producing protein, then the animals produce the waste, and then it is recycled. It's one of the interesting things about natural communities. There are these so-called cycles in which things are used, converted, and then the waste is reconverted and then reused again. And in other words, the waste products are not just, don't just pile up, they are reused. For example, supposing in a forest, a tree dies, what happens in the course of time is decays and ultimately will become human. If this were not so, the forest would be piled up, you see, with trees and dead leaves and such, that, you know, there'd be nothing. But this decays and forms humus and then it's recycled. Well, in our community, however, what are we doing with the waste? It's not being recycled, is it? We just dump out the bottles and the cans, and pretty soon there's going to be no place to dump them. And we can't send them off to the moon or to a spaceship either. So, in other words, we are a limited environment. You can't just dump them over the edge of the earth, you know, and they'll fall off into space. It doesn't work. So we have to begin to consider some of these things. We've got to begin to recycle some of our waste products. It can't pile up indefinitely. And you can't continue to pollute the streams, otherwise you're going to kill off your life. Incidentally, DDT is known to slow photosynthesis. If you continue to use it, dump it out, and it continues to accumulate, we're going to have a slowing down of photosynthesis again, which is the fundamental source of life. Mentioning now a bit about soil, also very fundamental part of our environment, particularly for plants. Your soil, there are various types of soil in the United States and actually in the world, and these coincide pretty well with the types of climate. In other words, the climate pretty much influences the kind of soil you're going to get. So there are desert-type soils, there are soils that we get in the semi-desert, and there's a kind of soil we get in the tropics, and so on. Also, correlating with this, we find that certain plants will grow in certain regions and others don't. And it would be smart if we would observe what grows in a particular area and then capitalize on this and grow that type of thing. For example, in the tropics, we have a type of soil called bladerite. It's a red soil, there's clay, right? Composed essentially of iron oxide and aluminum oxide, fine for ore, but very poor for growing things. In the tropics, you can find tropical forests. However, supposing you decide that, well, you know, why don't we chop this down and be practical and grow something like wheat and rye, something that the people can use instead of these tropical forests? Well, the Army Corps of Engineers thought this was a smart idea, so that went in and did in certain areas. And what happened? Bladerite has very few nutrients in it. It will support perhaps one or two crops maximum. After that, it's excellent for building materials, but nothing else. It's a clay-like consistency. You add water to it and sun, and it bakes into an excellent brick. It's very good building materials, but it's impossible for growing wheat or these type of crops. The only reason these tropical forests are able to survive is in there, you see, for years, and the roots have a symbiotic relationship. In other words, they're closely associated with fungus, so they get their nutrients from this, not from the soil. And when you chop down what was there and, of course, remove this relationship, what have you got? You have then this soil, simply there, you can grow one or two crops, but after this, then it just turns into a brick pavement, completely useless. So this is one of the problems with bladerite. It can't be used, unfortunately, for the kind of things that we grow in the northern part of our country. In other area, the Mekong River Valley, the same kind of, they have the same kind of soil later on. But they have been able to grow rice there yearly. Why? Because of the, quote, harmful flooding of the river, which brings in then a veneer of topsoil, which enables them to grow rice year after year. Supposing now we send in, you know, this flooding's harmful, why don't we cut it out, you know, and send in a dam, put up a dam, you know, to prevent this. Again, we're upsetting a condition that has been actually desirable, although it may not seem so. In some cases, sometimes flooding can be desirable.
Well, that,
as far as soil is concerned, let me mention a little bit about water now. Again, extremely important. Water is the environment of many of our plants and animals, and also it's essential, of course, for life. What's been happening as far as the water is concerned, we are contaminating our streams and the ocean, both of these. What about some of these contaminants in the streams? Just heat, for example, has been harmful. Well, what's wrong with a little heat? But we study the life cycles of fish and other animals. We find that as the temperature of the water increases, or the temperature of the environment increases, so too does the metabolism, the whole reproductive cycle. In other words, fruit fly, for example, if you were to grow it at room temperature, which would be about 60 or 70, I guess depends on whose room you're in. But at any rate, if you grow it about this temperature, they'll have a life cycle of about 15 days, but if you just increase the temperature up to 80 degrees, which apparently is the temperature of some people's rooms too, then the life cycle, instead of 15 days, is down to 10 days. What does this mean? Everything is speeded up, plus require more food and otherwise. In addition, if we raise the temperature, certain fish cannot survive at all. In other words, and if you raise the temperature above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, virtually nothing will survive. So as you raise the temperature, it means that your organisms require more food, and probably there is less food because other organisms are dying. Secondly, raising the temperature increases the demand or need for oxygen because you can see that metabolism. Whereas there will be less oxygen as you raise the temperature of water. What bubbles off? Up comes the oxygen. We find that the maximum percentage of oxygen in water is when it gets close to freezing. So as you raise the temperature, there will be less oxygen. The animals will need more. So you think there can be a problem in this heat. Chemicals, another problem. Not only in streams, but in lakes. We find that just adding organic substances to a lake can quickly end the life of the lake. Lakes have what we call life histories of like animals and other organisms. But usually the life of the lake is in thousands of years, not tens or hundreds of years. But by dumping organic and things into lakes, we are changing the life cycle or life history of a lake from thousands of years to tens of years or such. Lake Erie, of course, would be an example in which pollution is becoming high, although there's still fish in Lake Erie. Apparently they've even banned the eating of these because of harmful chemical compounds, including mercury, which is above the acceptable level. Well, what happens if we dump things into a lake? Here's your lake. Supposing we just dump some, few little organic compounds in. Okay, you know, not really. And what happens? Well, the bacteria then start working on these, they're organic, and begin to convert them. Well, the bacteria use oxygen. This will tend to cut down the oxygen, and these products then will be broken down, and gradually you're going to begin to decrease the amount of oxygen in the bottom of the lake, begin to get stagnation, and gradually your lake is going to die off, so to speak. In other words, reach the end of its distance. We call this process of the lake so-called filling in. This could occur naturally just because plants, you know, gradually fall in at the edge and, you know, then the bacteria result in decay. This could gradually happen in any lake, But if you dump things in, obviously it's going to speed it up. This process is called eutrophication. In other words, we're dumping things in and speeding up this decay or stagnation of your plate by cutting down oxygen and otherwise. So again, this can create problems. In California, I'm sure you heard about the oil slick. And again, here would be another example of a catastrophe that has occurred. Things, again, present in many birds and otherwise dying because of this. Temperature and sunlight are also important. What's going to happen to the temperature in the future, we don't know because of this aspect of carbon dioxide. If this greenhouse effect should take over and the temperature should raise, actually the average temperature wouldn't have to rise too extensively to begin to melt some of the ice caps, Greenland ice caps, for example, and maybe some of the snow at North Pole and South Pole. Actually, if all the snow should melt, which probably wouldn't happen, but if it should, if all the ice caps should melt, the sea level would rise some 200 or 300 feet. Well, this would mean that maybe Mount Whitney might be not a pretty good place to have your house rather than along the coast, because any elevation you see lower than 200 or 300 feet would become inundated.
How much
did you get elevated? 200 to 300 feet. If the ice cap should melt. So these are some other aspects. The one thing I might mention concerning the simplification of the environment and growing single communities results in having problems with parasites. And what has meant, what have we done then with these? We have used pesticides. Well, true, it's, they have helped us to a certain extent tremendously. Without these, of course, we would have tremendous crop spoilers. But there's also been a problem with these, particularly those that are persistent, which would be DDT and some of the others. Because not only they've been used, okay, they're fine maybe for a while, but then your organisms or insects become resistant to these. Why is this? Because invariably, in a population, you have variation because of sexual reproduction. No two organisms are the same. So you have this variation in the population. Well, in the variation in the population, some will be resistant to certain things. What happens then? Those that are resistant survive, those that aren't don't. Okay, the resistant ones to DDT survive. And then pretty soon you've got nothing but resistant species. So then what do you have to do? The next year you have to use more DDT to kill off most of them, but again you've got some resistant ones. And they survive, so you keep having to increase the dosage because of this resistance factor. Always in a population, you're going to have variable organisms, and a few are going to be resistant to certain things. Same type of thing we can have with the use of antibiotics. We find that certain bacteria in a general population of bacteria are going to be resistant, perhaps, to certain antibiotics. And then you kill off all those that are not resistant, and again, the resistant ones multiply, and what have you got? You could end up with a strain of resistant bacteria. This is one of the reasons why it would be impossible to sell antibiotics on the open market. You can imagine, you know, how people douse up on aspirins and all other pills that are a bit readily available. Same thing would be true of antibiotics, then what would we have? Obviously, all the bacteria in existence would be immune to any of the antibiotics on the open market. It would have to be that way. But, so, this is one of the, another one of the problems is that when you have just a single crop, then these pests come along, then you try things to remove them, then this resistance factor can also be a problem. One other thing I would like to mention, then I'll open it up for discussion. Fire. It would have been an interesting thing. Normally, with fire, you think of it being extremely harmful, and let's put out fire by all possible means. However, there is also a ecology of fire. Certain plants can are dependent upon a fire before they will reproduce. It's true of certain of your conifers. They will not reproduce unless there's a fire. The cones remain closed and do not open unless they have the heat of a fire. Incidentally, a fire, a rapid fire going through an area, can be desirable because it will add nitrogen to the soil and remove a lot of the brush. Well, in certain areas of the Southwest, there used to be fires that occurred every 7 to 10 years. These would be quick fires that would go through, wipe out the underbrush and perhaps the small seedlings, and then add nutrients to the soil, and in the meantime, enable certain of these trees to reproduce, and then after the fire, they need to get some others coming up. So the appearance then in this general area was rather a park-like, because it cleaned out all the underbrush, and then you had these big trees, you see, that fire was not hot enough to kill the big trees. It was just a rapid, quick fire just to take care of a 2 or 3 years undergrowth, and those trees that had been 7 or 8 years old or older, you see, would survive. But it would be a quick fire that would be not tremendously destructive. Supposing now, instead, we fire prevention program, which we make sure that there are no fires in the area. Well, so for perhaps 20 years, there's a new fire in this particular area. What happens? You have an awful lot of underbrush, you have an awful lot of trees, all different sizes. And what happens? Then supposing lightning, or maybe someone drops a cigarette or otherwise, but anyway, it's inevitable. After a period of time, there is going to be a fire, supposing there is. Then, because there's so much underbrush, so much stuff that hasn't been cleaned out, you see, periodically, what happens? Now when you have your fire, it's a real holocaust and complete destruction. It destroys not only the underbrush, but everything. Its large trees are destroyed too. And this is what has happened, actually, in certain areas because of a fire prevention program. So in certain areas, what I'm going to do, maybe it might be smart to have frequent fires, maybe every 3 years, to burn out the underbrush, but to prevent, you see, a really bad fire that would be so hot it could destroy the big trees. It's rather interesting.
I understand. This is how the Indians can ensure that we have enough deer populations burn out every couple of years. We may have a lot of little fresh green stuff to feed the deer and keep up the deer population by burning off.
But we went to the Santa Barbara area after the fire, big fire, I don't remember what year it was, about in the early 60s. And it was absolutely fantastic what that place looked like the year after the fire, because it removed all these, it was generally chaparral, which is shrubby big stuff. It had removed all this stuff and supplied the soil with a lot of nutrients. It was absolutely fantastic what came up. In other words, these seeds lie dormant in the soil until, you know, the competition is removed, and they're absolutely fantastic. They look like the botanical garden. It really looks better. It made the botanical garden look rather sticky than all of that. It was just absolutely fantastic. But then by about the third year, it takes about 7 years to rebuild the chaparral. By about the third year, it really looks pretty much like old stuff again. And by the seventh, now it's about back to normal. Do you have any questions you want to ask concerning some of these aspects?
I have one thing I want to add. In Portland, where we have pulp and paper mills, or in places where pulp and paper mills, the sulfur barges is now getting off sulfur dioxide as it goes down the river. It's going to be just also polluting the air and becoming a problem with the
Yeah, salt. This can be extremely bad. There's an area in Tennessee in which the mines gave off sulfur dioxide and resulted in producing a real problem there. Absolutely zero vegetation. In other words, it completely killed everything. It looks like it's just completely devoid of anything. And of course, once you wipe out the vegetation, then of course you've got a problem with erosion and other factors. It'd be really bad.
The greenhouse effect is fascinating here. It's a concept that I had speaking to Dennis Forrest here. I asked you about whether carbon dioxide was, is carbon dioxide the most important thing contributing to this greenhouse effect?
Yes. And also carbon dioxide is probably the one that is seems to be increasing or could be increasing tremendously within the past 2 years or so, you see, because of our increased population, because of our increased burning of coal, oil, and all of these things, and because of our cutting down of trees, all of these factors would increase the carbon dioxide content.
And it doesn't depend on, so it doesn't layer out, so it doesn't have to be a layer of carbon dioxide.
No.
It's just a total increase in concentration.
It tends to absorb the heat rays as they're re-radiated.
So the food found in that accumulates, but the DDT that accumulates in the human body
comes from
any particular source of food?
It tends to concentrate in these fatty tissues.
Yeah, but I mean, what
food
does DDT contribute
to? The vegetation has very little and has given a bit of it.
Yeah, but the point is you couldn't eat just vegetation because you'd have to eat so much, but then, you know, that again, you probably might end up with more even though there would be less in the vegetation. Pardon? I've heard some biologists claim that they weren't going to eat liver anymore because, as you see, the liver does tend to concentrate a lot of these things, and although liver being desirable, you see, because of these other aspects, might be undesirable.
There hasn't been any study made of
the
oil.
No, I wouldn't. I would hesitate to single out one or the other thing, anyhow, because actually, if you find that if you cut out certain things, maybe you eat more of the other, and then you might, even though they had less concentration, you see, you might end up with more in the long run. But it's rather interesting that this food chain, although no DDT has been spread up in the Arctic, what would you use DDT up there, we do find a very high level of DDT, relatively high level, in the, you'll see, in the fat of some of the animals up there. It is all over. It isn't just in certain isolated areas where this is sprayed with us.
So someday down in Arizona is overusing DDT or using DDT, it's going to affect us.
Right.
Anyway.
Yes, it doesn't mean that it's going to be just there because it could travel right around the surface of the earth, you see, in tiny particles.
Matter of recycling of waste, their hope for technology and their hope for the future is that we're going to be able to speed up that process. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, I think this is one of the big problems, to recycle waste, because this is the problem of pollution, this is the problem of things piling up. Paul had mentioned until we begin to make it very, very desirable for these companies to recycle, probably they're not going to. In other words, the taxing should be such that make it absolutely essential for them to recycle. In other words, if they get, for example, for returning bottles, in other words, it should be a good amount of money that you get for returning bottles, so that maybe if you're too lazy to, the kids in your neighborhood are going to go around, by golly, and there won't be any broken bottles around. They're going to see to it that they get back to the store if they got 10 cents a bottle or something really worth it. By golly, they'd get back to the store.
All agreed that legislation was desirable to do this?
Yeah, some type of taxation or otherwise, making it really essential that...
Isn't the difference in the plastic still being more of a problem?
Yes, plastic is a real problem because this is not degradable, right?
And you burn the stuff, and I don't know anything that makes sootier, greasier, dirtier.
Yeah, it's indestructible.
Than burning
Some students or somebody that took that all these non-deposit, no-return bottles, and they went to Canada Dry and just did a truckload, and dumped them at their gate.
Yeah, well, this company will pay some of the town.
How many
answers
in the town?
Plastic petri dishes, which your desk don't get rid of, you know.
And years ago for different functions we used a metal basin for this, metal basin for that. But now it's all plastic. Every casing in the hospital, we get a great big bag of plastic stuff to use.
Mm-hmm.
And
everyone gets
it new again and again and again. And plastic disposable syringes, there's thousands a day.
And there are things that you don't even think about, I mean, that we use all the time. Take, for example, disposable diapers. Here's something else, you know, instead of reusing the cloth, they got these disposable diapers that aren't really disposable, you know.
That's right.
That's
why I think it's the same 20 years from now.
Another thing is, what sells more, colored toilet paper or white? The white is biodegradable, but the color isn't. Don't buy any more colored toilet paper.
Is that right?
Yeah, the dye on it prevents it from being smeared.
Try to find it.
First day I came up here, we had colored toilet paper here, and before I got stuff in the morning, I saw white paper and said, okay. So, a colored cleaner.
Another thing that bothers me, though, is not only this sort of waste and spoilage of the environment, but just actual waste of conventional things. For example, is anyone aware of the wasted food, for example? And I can talk about hospital because I know, but at the end of the day, let's say in the cafeteria, and this might be the staff cafeteria, I know about that, all these salads that are sitting there on ice, at the end of the day, do you think that they let the kids who work there eat those salads? Not on your life. Down the disposal. Great big lemon meringue pies that have never been cut. And many of the kids in hospitals that are in the inner city area, those kids work there, and they're poor kids, you know, I mean, they come from a home where there isn't much money. And these kids work there in the food service. At the end of the day, do you think they let them, those kids take the pies home? No, down the disposal.
Why is that?
Great big little pies. It just makes me cry.
Why is that?
Oh, there's something about the food and health laws about that. Or they have all kinds of excuses, but they've never been able to give me an excuse that satisfies you. But because of the politics of me, I think I better be quiet for you. But I think it's just a sin.
I think all of these institutions should make all their leftover food at the end of the day
available
to
staff or government
or to any people that want it.
And I, one thing I asked about here, what are they doing the left food? They tell me they serve the breakfast leftovers and coffee break. Great.
French
toast. I mean, it's a sin to throw this food away in the hospital. And I have to do it. It goes on in hospitals, it goes on in hotels. And
I know. All public institutions.
We don't smoke in our home, but have you ever, my sister just arrived from Rhode Island, and have you ever seen 40 filters in a series of ashtrays? She smoked two packages a day. This to me is the filthiest thing in the world. The what's left over from a cigarette. Or a cigar, the plastic part, or I think this is this could be gone right back to the manufacturer, so we don't want
Milky.
Saving the plastic things, mouthpieces or whatever. I'm not against smoking, but 25 years ago there wasn't a filter
but you see all over the streets, even here.
Mm-hmm. But the COVID is infecting people's lungs, and that's really more important to cut down lung cancer than this.
Okay, I have about 10 o'clock, so those of you who want to go, otherwise we can continue the discussion, anyone else who wants to.
Do you have a yard?
Yeah.
What do you use to fertilize the yard?